Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we continue now with the study of the Chachaka Sutta. This is the discourse on the six sixes, or the six sets of six. And in this sutta, the Buddha begins by with what we call the synopsis, in which he mentions the six sets of six, which are the six internal sense bases, six external sense bases, the six types or classes of consciousness, six classes of contact, six classes of feeling, and six classes of craving. And he says that all of these things should be understood. Okay, and last week we went through the six internal sense bases, six external sense bases, and six classes of consciousness. Okay, and now we come to, we're on page 1130, paragraph 7, we're up to the six classes of contact. Okay, so now it says, the six classes of contact should be understood, so it was said, and with reference to what was this said, or in other words, what is the meaning of this? Okay, now in what follows, the Buddha is going to explain the meaning of contact. Okay, dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. This we've had already in the explanation of the six types of consciousness. Okay, so now the meeting of the three is contact. And similarly with each of the other sense bases, ear and sounds, ear consciousness arises, the meeting of the three is contact. All the ways down, dependent on the mind base and mental objects, that is, the internal objects of thought, imagination, ideation, and so on, mind consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. Okay, so here we have a word which in Pali and as well as in English is being used somewhat metaphorically. A word is taken which originally has a physical denotation, a physical significance. The word, the Pali word pasa, like the English word contact, or literally touch. Well, the Pali word pasa originally meant literally touch or touching. And here, contact is explained in terms of another word. In Pali, the word is sangati, which means literally going together. Maybe in English it would sound better to say coming together. So it's the coming together of what? Of three things. The three things are, in the case of eye contact, it would be the coming together or meeting of eye forms and eye consciousness. And similarly with each of the other sense bases, internal, external, and consciousness. But to understand what is taking place, to understand more precisely what is taking place in contact, we have to explain a little at a finer level of detail what is meant by this meeting or coming together of eye forms and consciousness. It's not simply like baking a cake where you throw in flour, milk, egg, and mix them together to make the cake. And then bake it, you get the cake. But there's a certain order or sequence here. And what, the way I would explain contact, it is the meeting of consciousness with its object through the internal sense base. We could, in fact, sometimes the internal sense bases are also called doors. They speak of the sense doors. Dwara is used. The Pali word is etymologically connected with the English word door. Dwara. So we have the eye door, ear door, nose door, tongue door, body door, mind door. And what do we use a door for? What happens through a door? In? Enter? Yeah. Enter and leave, right? Okay, so we could say that the doors, the sense faculties, function as doors through which consciousness goes out metaphorically. It goes out to meet the objects. Or we could also say that the senses are doors through which the objects come in order to meet consciousness. And so this event when consciousness meets the sense object through the sense base, that event is called contact. And contact, it's an actual event that takes place, very subtle event. And it occurs very quickly, so that this occurrence of contact usually gets, because it occurs very quickly and it initiates the experience. And so usually, well, what happens when contact takes place, it triggers off a feeling and a perception, as well as other things, thoughts, intentions. But in the first instance, when we meet a sense object that immediately strikes us for the first time, what that sense object immediately triggers off is sometimes it's a perception, especially in the case of visual experience, generally auditory experience. We see things, hear things, and we usually distinguish at once what we see, what we hear. And so that visual perception immediately overwhelms and drowns out the contact. And through the other senses, smelling, tasting, touching, generally feeling becomes very prominent. Of course, there's perception there too, and there's also feeling through the eye and through the ear. But with the other senses, maybe feeling is more prominent, and then that will tend to drown out the event of contact. Through the mind door, then it's our purposes, our intentions, our thoughts. They are most prominent, and they drown out the event of contact. And so contact is just like maybe to use a little simile, it's just like the doorman at a famous hotel, at a very important hotel where a lot of famous people go, movie stars, sports stars, rock stars, and like nobody pays much attention to the doorman, you know. He's just like, almost like he's not a living being there. He's just part of the building. But he's there greeting everybody who's coming in and going out. Good day, sir. Goodbye, sir. Goodbye, ma'am. But the doorman is there when all the more famous and important people are coming in, going out. The crowds gather not to greet the doorman. Nobody cares about the doorman when he finishes his job. He changes his clothes, goes home, and nobody pays any attention to him. But he's always at the door there when the big movie stars, sports stars, rock stars come and go out of the hotel. So that is contact. Rather insignificant figure, but if there's no contact, it's like there's nobody to open the door to the hotel. We have to assume that this hotel is one of these high security hotels. Maybe let's say it's like the American embassy in some foreign country where you have to have a buzzer, that somebody presses the buzzer to open the door to the embassy. So you need that doorman to press the buzzer to open the door. So if contact isn't there, no perceptions, no feelings, no volitions. Okay, so now we have the six classes of contact. Okay, now we come to the next section, 8. The six classes of feeling should be understood. And with reference to what was this said? Okay, dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. This is starting to look familiar. Doesn't it look familiar? Where have we seen this before? Dependent origination. Yeah. Okay, so once contact takes place, then there is a feeling. Feeling is the way we experience the object. and feeling takes place with every experience of an object. The feeling can be pleasant feeling, can be painful feeling, or it can be what is called feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant, a dukkhama sukha vedana. Okay, and this is all taking place very, very quickly. So quickly that we don't notice how fast it's occurring. And so through each sense door we have has its own feeling. And then we come to section 9, the 6 classes of craving should be understood. So now with this we can see the purpose why the Buddha has been sketching the sequence of these different events that make up, we call this the process of experience. He's zooming in on craving, because craving is one of the key links in the chain of origination of dukkha, of suffering. And in order to break this chain, one has to see how craving originates. Okay, so the 6 classes or 6 types of craving should be understood. And here the Buddha doesn't just mention them, doesn't just enumerate them, but he shows genetically, that means by way of origin, how the craving originates. So dependent, and in each case he goes back to the very beginning, bringing in the internal and external sense bases. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the 3 is contact. All of this is automatic. With contact as condition, there is feeling. That is automatic. Then, this is what is not automatic. With feeling as condition, there is craving. This is the place where one can break the cycle. The cycle that continually locks us into the process by which we create more suffering for ourselves by yielding to craving and the offshoots of craving like hatred, jealousy, anger, competitiveness, clinging. Through all of this, we create more experience, suffering for ourselves in our day-to-day lives. And then by flowing along with this stream of craving, we engage in activities that build up, that create karma. This is action with the potential or force to generate new existence, new states of becoming within samsara. And then this craving working in conjunction with the karma eventually it will generate or produce new existence at the time of death. It will produce new existence, new birth, followed by new growth, new aging, and more death. So that is the cycle of existence, the cycle of samsara. And so one of the key nodes now in that process is craving. And so now the Buddha has brought this teaching, this first section, this exposition of the six sixes to its culmination, its climax, by showing how in the ordinary person, the unenlightened or ignorant person, normal sensory experience that we take to be just something that is happening in a very routine way, that this sensory experience is actually at subtle levels the hidden mechanism, the hidden dynamism that is generating or creating, giving rise to more craving. And it is by repeatedly yielding to this craving, by going along with the flow of craving, by rejoicing in that craving, that we create suffering and that we perpetuate our existence within samsara, the round of birth and death. Okay, now, what keeps craving intact? What is it that sustains or maintains craving? What is the underlying root of craving? What is it? Right, the underlying root of craving is avijja, or ignorance. And so in order to get rid of ignorance, what is the remedy or the antidote? Yeah, but something more specific. Right, the antidote is wisdom, panya, prajna. Okay, so now the Buddha in the next section is going to lay a foundation for this panya by showing what has to be seen with wisdom. And what has to be seen is the selfless nature of all of the phenomena that one ordinarily holds to and identifies with, and that one holds to and identifies with as myself. We might say that out of this craving, there develops clinging. Clinging is actually the next factor in dependent origination that follows on craving. And one of the forms that clinging takes is the holding to all of the factors of individual identity, one's individual personal identity, holding to these factors as being, this is mine, this is I, this is myself. And so to break the grip of this identification with things as being mine, I, and myself, then one needs this insight or wisdom that understands these phenomena as being not myself, as being non-self. And so in the next section, the Buddha is going to give a kind of demonstration that all of these phenomena are truly non-self, not myself. And I have to explain my own understanding of the Buddha's teaching of anatta. The point is not to assert a doctrine that there is no self. That this is commonly explained to be the point of the teaching on anatta. I don't think that's the correct explanation. But this doesn't mean that the Buddha is trying to teach in a subtle way that, or that the Buddha is trying to deny certain things, that certain things are the self, in order to affirm in a subtle way that there is a self. But rather, he's teaching that all these different phenomena are non-self, because his teaching has a practical purpose, and that is to break the clinging, to break the identification with things as self. And I believe, or I understand from the Buddha's point of view, the very idea of self or of having a self in itself is a kind of illness or a symptom of this clinging. And so the Buddha uses this teaching of anatta, first when a theorist comes along with the idea or the thesis, I have a self, there is a self, the Buddha asks him, what is it that you mean by myself? What do you take to be myself? Then the theorist will usually say, I take this to be myself. I take that to be myself. And then once the theorist has identified something to be the self, then the Buddha will question that theorist. Is this thing that you are taking to be self permanent or impermanent? And he'll make the theorist see that it's impermanent. And then once the theorist sees that it's impermanent, then the Buddha will lead him to see that what is impermanent cannot be identified as self. But the Buddha does continue to use the word self as a valid notion, a valid idea, in reference to the empirical person as an agent of action, in the sense of one bearing personal responsibility for one's deeds, as in the sense of the need to make a personal effort for one's purification, for one's liberation. The Buddha will say, you must purify yourself, you must work for your own liberation. No one can purify another. Each one must purify himself, herself. And he's using that word atta, the same word self. So this is a valid idea with a limited reference, as long as it's not taken to signify a kind of permanent basis for individual identity. As long as it's taken as just a convenient designation for the individual empirical person. In that sense, it's a perfectly valid notion. But when it becomes an object of clinging or an object of metaphysical speculation, then one has to force the theorist or oneself to examine and see what is it that one is identifying with as oneself. And when one looks into this question and sees what is it that one is identifying with, then one will see that this base of identification is impermanent. And because it's impermanent, it's not really satisfactory. Not a base of security and true happiness. And because it's impermanent, unsatisfactory, it should not be identified with as a self and cannot be identified with as a self in the sense of a true, substantial, lasting basis of individual identity. Okay, now if we turn to paragraph 10 in the sutta, we'll see how the Buddha applies this examination of the notion of self. Okay, if anyone says the I is self, that is not tenable. Now, it seems to me a little bit odd that somebody would be taking the I to be myself in the sense of the whole person, to single out the I as being myself. But I think what is taking place is somebody might be identifying this whole complex to be myself. And so the I is part of it, one aspect of this whole psychophysical entity that's being taken to be myself. Okay, so if somebody takes the I to be the self, now in Indian thought, during the Buddha's time, this idea of atta as a metaphysical idea suggested the notion of something which is everlasting, which is stable and which has a stable and continuous existence. And so, if one says that the I is myself, one has to examine the I. And by examining it, this means examining the I not just casually, but examining it with insight. And when one pays attention to the I with insight, one sees that this faculty that one calls the I is subject to constant arising and falling away, to arising and passing. And so this I, the sense faculty of the I, is constantly coming into being and passing out of being, arising, and passing many, many times, even in a second. And so if one were to say that the I is arising, the I is myself, then one would have to say, myself arises and falls away. But this would lead to a somewhat strange consequence, because suppose at this moment I say the I is myself. What is the exact time now? 7:37. Okay, 7:37, I say the I is myself. Then the I is arising and passing. At 7:38, there'll be a new I faculty will have come into existence. So the I existing at 7:37 will be gone. So if I say the I is myself, the I of 7:37 has fallen away. And that means myself has fallen away. So which is my true self? The I of 7:37 or the I of 7:38? And if it's the I of 7:38, what happens at 7:39 and 7:40? But one might want to say, it's not the I at any single minute that is the self, or any single moment, but the I is continuous. That I is continually the self. But then the I is continually arising and falling away. And then having a self which is constantly arising and falling away, that seems very unsatisfactory. It means that one is constantly having a new self every moment, a different self every moment, or a self which is just made up of sort of broken, disconnected moments of selfhood, which is quite different from our ordinary conception of ourself as something which is constant, continual, retaining its identity, unbroken, unchanged through time. Okay, so for this reason, the Buddha says, it is not tenable, not valid for anyone to say the I is self. And thus the conclusion follows that the I is not self. Okay, similarly, if anyone says forms are self, it would seem a little bit strange for anybody to think or to say forms in the sense of visible objects seen outwardly are self, unless he has some kind of psychotic condition whereby I think these books are myself, or the desk is myself. Though sometimes people do identify with things so deeply that, you know, if they, maybe somebody gets a new computer, they love it so much. If the computer breaks down, they say, oh, I feel as if a part of myself has been destroyed. Maybe in that sense, one could say for them, forms are self. But one might think forms are mine. This could be more an antidote to clinging than to the identification with external objects as being self. One might think external objects are mine, and so when one thinks something is mine, one wants to have a kind of continual, permanent possession of it. But since these outer objects are undergoing arising and falling, and eventually all outer objects perish and fall away, then one would have to say that in the ultimate sense, nothing is really mine, because everything that I cling to and take to be mine must eventually perish and disappear. And so there's nothing, not even this body, that I can take to be truly mine. Okay, then, if anyone says, I consciousness is self, the event of knowing forms through the I. Okay, that is not tenable because I consciousness arises and passes away. Okay, and one could apply the same reasoning to all of these other factors, eye contact, and this same chain of reasoning can go all the ways through till we come right out at page 1133, the paragraph 15. Well, actually, each one goes up to craving. I'm sorry, let's go back to 10. Okay, so one identifies with eye consciousness. Eye contact usually goes so quickly, nobody identifies with contact normally. But to the extent that one identifies with this whole process, the whole compound, taking it to be mine, then contact is also included in that. Feeling is included in that. And then to the extent that one enjoys this craving and takes craving to be the source of one's pleasure, the source of one's enjoyment, then one identifies with that craving itself and takes craving to be one's true self. There have been philosophers who have had this idea that it's this will to live that is one's true identity, and that will to live is another name for craving. But even this craving is subject to arising and falling away. So when one examines this craving, that cannot be taken to be self. So even this craving turns out to be not self. Okay, so one can apply the same examination to each of the senses, taking us all the ways through to the end of paragraph 15. Okay, maybe at this point I'll ask if there is any questions.
In dependent origination, consciousness is listed before nama-rupa and the sixfold days.
Yeah.
And yet, in here, if this I, the six kinds of consciousness, as arising from contact.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting question. And you see, it's in the usual formula of dependent origination, that one has consciousness after the volitional formations and before nama-rupa. But in the Nidana Samyutta, that's the collection of suttas on dependent origination in the Samyutta Nikaya, one also finds suttas, a few suttas, which use this formula. That is, which use the formula of beginning with the six internal base, with the beginning with the internal and external sense bases as the starting point for the arising of consciousness, then going from consciousness to contact, feeling, craving, on to the end of the dependent origination formula. There are a few suttas like that. So it's not that dependent origination is just one fixed formula working in just one fixed order, but it's a rather complex process with let's say, streams of causation working in different directions. But the way I would see it now, the usual formula of dependent origination, the 12 factors laid out the way we find it in Sutta number 38 or Sutta number 9 in the Majjhima Nikaya, this is for the purpose of showing the whole series in the round of existence, the causal dynamism beneath the round of samsara, from the standpoint of three successive existences, and taking here ignorance and volitional formations, avijja and sankhara, as representing one existence, usually said to be the past existence, and those are functioning causally in relation to consciousness, which is the first point in the origination of the next existence. And so there we find consciousness as the starting point of the second existence. And then consciousness, when it arises, it brings along nama rupa. Nama rupa here is the psychophysical organism, the whole complex of mind and body, except for consciousness. Consciousness is, I call it, the channel that maintains the rebirth process. Then nama, mentality, are the other mental factors that go along with consciousness, like feeling, perception, volition. And then, of course, one needs the body, that's rupa, to support consciousness. Okay, and then from the evolution or development of the body, the six sense bases emerge, the body together with consciousness. From the evolution of the body with consciousness, the six sense bases emerge. And then from, those are the six internal sense bases. And then from that, contact takes place, leading to feeling, and then craving. In this sutta, and in other suttas which use this type of presentation, we're beginning within an existence which is already established, and seeing how from sensory experience within this existence, once one has the internal sense bases already established, how through the interaction between the internal sense bases, let's say how from the impingement of sense objects upon the internal sense bases, consciousness arises, and then from the interaction of these three, contact takes place, leading to feeling, leading to craving. And so the two are complementary, they're not contradictory.
I don't understand what's meant by the arising and passing away of the, let's say, of the eye base.
Yeah.
Because when you described it last week, you talked about the eye base, but not in terms of the biological, but the eye, but in terms of the that which is the base for the arising of consciousness. And I'm trying to understand that base for the arising of consciousness, yeah. Something that arises and passes away.
Yeah.
In that sense, can you explain that?
Yeah, that is something which has to be contemplated with insight when the mind gets very, very subtle, to actually see the arising and passing of these subtle sense bases. But at a, let us say, but one could use, without getting the mind to that very subtle and sensitive level, where one could actually directly contemplate the arising and passing of these sensitive material phenomena, one could get a sense for the arising and falling away of the eye just by using the, let's call it the gross eye organ, just by reflecting on how this gross eye organ is subject to constant arising and falling away. Even if we can't experience this at the level of insight, where we get the insight into Udayabhaya, that's arising and passing away, but one could use reasoning or reflection based on scientific evidence of how the cells of the eye are constantly changing, they're constantly absorbing nutrients, metabolizing the nutrients, expelling waste, then one understands how the cells of the eye are constituted of molecules, and those molecules are constituted of atoms. The atoms are constituted of subatomic particles. These subatomic particles are what? Protons, electrons, neutrons, and neutrons are just, what are they? Neutrons are protons together with electrons or something else within them? Physicists, anybody in physics? And then these particles are, there are all sorts of families of these subatomic particles, mesons, muons, gluons, bisons. That's the finest level. Okay, you get to the finest level, or even before you get to that level, but all of these particles, what are they? But just streams of energy, which are just, their existence is not even continuous so far as, you know, physics can determine. They're just discrete bundles of energy, which arise and pass away. You know, so what you call an electron, it's not like though it's depicted this way in elementary physics classes, like a little ping pong ball circling around bigger ping pong balls at the middle of the atom. But the electron, it's actually just flashes of energy, which now it's here, then it's gone, then it's reappearing here, a little bit further down, then it's gone, and it's reappearing a little further down. So it's actually coming into being, vanishing out of being, then coming into being again, out of being. And then everything, this table, microphone, book, this body is made up of these particles which are just coming into being and going out of being. And I tell you that when one develops the insight knowledges, I don't know about experiencing it at the level of quarks, but one could bring the mindfulness and awareness to the level that one could experience pretty much at the cellular level, molecular level, almost seemingly at the atomic level, arising and passing away. Any further questions? Yeah.
I'm confused about when you said that the Buddha is not teaching that there is no self.
Yeah.
Because this is, okay, you know, there are five aggregates.
Yeah.
It's all around the finite. And last week we talked about there are these six types of consciousness, and it's all the types of consciousness. It's all the different types of senses.
Yeah.
It's a boundary. Then he says, none of these things are self.
Yeah.
Doesn't that sort of imply?
One could draw inferences, but I have not seen any statement in the suttas that come from the Buddha himself which say there is no self. The closest that I have found is in the Alagadupama Sutta. There's a statement on page 232, paragraph 25, at the top of the page, bhikkhus, monks, there being a self, if there is a self, will there be for me what belongs to a self? Okay, yes. Or there being what belongs to a self, if there's anything that belongs to a self, would I have a self? Yes. Okay. Since a self and what belongs to a self are not apprehended as true and established, then this standpoint for views, namely, that which is the self is the world, after death I shall be permanent, and so on, doesn't it seem to be an utterly and completely foolish teaching? Okay, here we have the statement, since a self and what belongs to a self are not apprehended or not found as true and established. Okay, this is true. I mean, this is what the Buddha says. So one doesn't find a self as true and established. But that has a kind of different nuance to it, a different logic from saying there is no self. When one says there is no self, in a way, one is going against conventional usage and causing, I would say, confusion, because the way I would see it, the Buddha wants to use the notion of self, the language of self, at the level of encouraging people to make personal effort and admonishing people to take personal responsibility. And if he says there is no self, he seems to be undercutting that objective of his teaching project, and leaving himself almost in a position of contradicting himself. If he's saying, take personal responsibility, but you're saying there is no self, how should I be responsible? He says, you have to make the effort yourself. Why should I make the effort myself? I have no self. You're contradicting yourself, Venerable Sir.
We also have the conversation with Bhatyagota,
yeah.
Where he actually denies, there is no self to deny.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
There is something to deny that. He actually does deny.
Yeah.
That
yeah. This is the wonder of Bhatyagota. Let's see if I can remember how it goes. He comes to the Buddha and says, how is it, Master Gotama? Is there a self? the Buddha remains silent? No, I think you're remembering it wrong. The way I'm remembering the sutta that comes in Connected Discourses, Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha just remains silent. Vajragotha says, how is it, Master Gotama? Is there a self? The Buddha remains silent. Then Vajragotha says, how is it? Is there no self? The Buddha remains silent. Then Vajragotha just goes off puzzled. Then Ananda comes to the Buddha and says, why is it that you remain silent? Then the Buddha says, if when Vajragotha had asked me, is there a self, I had said, there is a self, then I would have been siding with the eternalists who say that there is a self. If when Vajragotha had asked me, then is there no self? I had said there is no self. Then I would have been on the side of the annihilationists. Then the Buddha gives another take to it. He says, if I had said that there is a self, then I would have been contradicting my own thesis that sabbe dhamma anatta, that all phenomena are non-self. On the other hand, the Buddha says, if I had said there is no self, then this poor Vajragotha would have been extremely confused, since he would have thought, formerly, previously, I had a self, but now the Master Gotama tells me I have no self. And so in that case, he thought silence was the best teaching. Then eventually later, Vajragotha came to the Buddha with other questions, and he became a disciple of the Buddha and became an arhant.
Many of the suttas, the Buddha is speaking to monks, sophisticated, knowledgeable monks who wouldn't be confused by what you had said earlier about the Buddha himself.
But still, maybe this is even strengthens the case for my position that the Buddha didn't teach that there is no self. I mean, if he was teaching monks who wouldn't be confused, then he should have said quite explicitly, when I teach other people, then I can use this conventional discourse of self, but now I have you around, my sophisticated disciple, so I'm letting you in on the secret, there isn't a self. But the Buddha didn't use that type of language. But always he used, he expressed himself by way of, these phenomena are non-self. And also that way of expression, these phenomena are non-self, I say that it has the a specific methodological purpose of directing the inquirer, whether it's a monk or an outside wanderer, to look at the phenomena and see and investigate, can we take this to be self? Whereas just saying there is no self, in a way it's almost proposing a metaphysical position that can't be tested. Because there's no, when you just say there is no self, then there's really no way to absolutely confirm that there isn't any self. you have to examine each and everything that one could possibly find to see that there is absolutely no self. But when you say, this is the field of clinging, the field of attachment, the five aggregates, and this is where the clinging that keeps one bound to the cycle of samsara, this is where that clinging is lodged, then one examines these five aggregates to determine, can one take this to be mine, I, or myself? And one can see what is really the, what I call the objective foundation for the teaching of non-self is the characteristic of impermanence. This is what one sees objectively, is that these phenomena, all these phenomena arise and pass away. And when one sees that they arise and pass away on this basis, one can move directly to the characteristic of non-self, that they're not self. That's for those who have somewhat sharp faculties. For others, the Buddha uses the second characteristic of dukkha, suffering or unsatisfactoriness. To release that clinging, one goes from impermanence, then one sees what's impermanent is unsatisfactory or bound up with suffering in some way. And so do you want to go on holding to what is bound up with suffering, what is causing misery, and continue to take that as being mine, I, and myself? Or do you want to let go of it and release it? And one takes that investigation from the coarser levels. This is the way the five aggregates are structured. The coarser level of bodily form, then going to feeling, then going to perception, then going to volition, till one comes to the subtlest level, which is consciousness. Especially in Indian thought of this period, or even before the Buddha's time, the great theorists and yogis and philosophers were developing the idea that at the base of the human being there was this radiant, blissful, all-pervading awareness, which is the Atman, the Self. But the Buddha probed into this so-called Atman and found that even this is just the factor of consciousness, conditioned, dependently originated, impermanent, and in subtle ways subject to dukkha. And so it's not Atman, not Atta, but Anatta, non-self. Oh, okay. So we have to end right now. Okay, we end with the sharing of the merits. I want to mention that on this table here there are some CDs that have the talks from this is volume 2 of the talks on the Majjhima Nikaya, so anybody is welcome to take them, to take one. Also, I want to mention on this coming Sunday, on the 16th, a few of us will be going into New York City for the, I don't like to use the word rally, it suggests agitation. I like to call it a vigil in support of the people of Darfur. And if anybody wants to join us, will be leaving. What time is a good time to leave from Bodhi Monastery? It starts at 2 o'clock, so probably about noon we should leave. So we will leave from Bodhi Monastery about 2 o'clock, at 12 noon. Okay, we end with the sharing of the merits. And there was a handout with all of the texts that I recite. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mantaram. Etavata ca ammehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca ammehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca ammehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhava gupadaya avici hetato etantare satakai upapanna.